This week, thinking about this morning, I was recalling my time in Los Angeles, where I often went to the Sri Lankan Vihara there, Sri Lankan temple, Dharma Vijaya Vihara, a slightly scruffy area of Los Angeles. And it's run by Sri Lankan monks, and they're not too keen on meditation practice, so they invite it because most of the non-Sri Lankans who would go there were interested in meditation, so the abbot had met a Japanese monk in Bodh Gaya years before, and so he invited that monk to come to the temple in Los Angeles. So this Japanese monk has been living there for years now, and he's crazy about meditation. That's all he likes to do. He doesn't like to teach or do anything much other than meditation. So it was a kind of amusing place to go to this Sri Lankan temple and get a good dose of meditation from their Japanese sort of guest, who often complained about the Sri Lankan food. But anyway, it was kind of a interesting community. And in the Sri Lankans, of course, are in the Theravadan tradition, and so they feel they are their material, so to speak. Their focus is on the much closer to the Buddha's words and the Buddha's teaching and so on. And so one of the formulations there, of course, is the three marks of existence. And this Japanese monk also liked to talk about the three marks of existence. And the first mark is anicca. Oh, I have written these all wrong way. Anicca, it's a Pali term, and I was looking this up on the web, and one of the incidental information there was that the term Pali actually is the word for canon. Doesn't actually mean the language originally, but it refers to the idea of canon. So we talk about the Pali canon. But apparently the word Pali actually means canon. And it was the language of the Magadhan kingdom of that area. Anyway, this is called a Pali term, anicca. And then the next word is dukkha, which you're more familiar with, maybe. Dukkha. And then the last one is anatta. So anicca, I meant to write these so this would stand up, but I did it wrong. So anicca refers to the lack of permanence, impermanence. And I usually think of it as meaning that everything changes. But there's a difference, I think, psychologically of understanding between everything changes and impermanence. Nothing is permanent. And this seems to be more the idea of impermanence. So I was thinking about bringing examples. So from my life, when I was quite young, 6 or 7 years old, in 1945, I think it was, I was listening to the radio, and the announcer said, the president has died. President Roosevelt has died. So I went running into my mom and I said, "Mother, mother, the president died, the president died." And I thought she would be delighted because I had always heard how terrible Roosevelt was. Just a horrible person. And his wife was even worse. So I thought my mom would be delighted that the president had died. But her face sort of fell when I said the president had died. And I just was mystified by that kind of reaction on her part. So that was a moment of impermanence. The president, of course, disappeared, and my assumptions about what was my reading of the adults in my family, what their take on things was, that was sort of destroyed, and I realized I wouldn't ever understand the adults anymore. So this is impermanence. I do, yeah. These are the adults. I just don't understand them. Well, of course, that gives rise to dukkha. If you feel the world is incomprehensible, it's always changing, and you can't depend on anything, and so on. You have a lot of dis-ease or discomfort. Thank you for this hot tea. I think that dukkha is in some ways overemphasized in Buddhism. I mean, sometimes the idea seems to be that that all life is suffering. All life is uncomfortable or disturbing or producing anxiety. And of course, in a sense, it's true in greater and lesser ways. But since there is so much delight and enjoyment and pleasure in life, it seems to me that to sort of give the idea that everything is really suffering, if we really understood it all, I think that gives a feeling to sort of ordinary people or people who perhaps don't have a profound sense moment to moment change of everything. Anyway, that it just seems to be a little bit overdone to say that life is suffering or life is miserable. And of course we all know that many people's lives are from beginning to end miserable, but it's not true in every case. So I think we have to appreciate dukkha because it does wake us up to reality. And it is the dukkha aspect of reality that makes us inquire into things. If we only had pleasure, of course, then we wouldn't inquire any further and we wouldn't investigate. So dukkha is certainly useful, if not If we don't want to say good, we can certainly say it's useful and, in a sense, necessary for the path. If we take the road down here from the highway down here to Jikoji, we can certainly see that that this road is impermanent. We all know that it changes a lot. It basically just gets worse. And even when we make improvements on it, they don't last too long. But part of the change or the impermanence of the road is that sometimes improvements are made, or some ditch or some terrible bump might be slightly improved for a while. And so this idea of that things are impermanent doesn't just mean everything is going to pot. It means that there is change, and sometimes we can see it as conducive or helpful, nourishing or something, and sometimes it's the opposite. And the road certainly causes discomfort. Many people's backs are somewhat stressed by the drive. And when you see the stones and so on, you worry about your tires. And it's a very good road to come to a Buddhist temple on. It makes you more aware of these marks of existence. And this road, of course, is the sort of prelude to the grounds of Jikoji. And then if you looked at the grounds of Jikoji, whether it's the buildings or the gardens or the paths, again, there, of course, you see impermanence and you suffer various sorts of discomfort. And sometimes you experience pleasure as well. I think the road and the grounds of Jikoji are all very nice, what would you say, indicators or manifestations of the marks of existence. The last one, anatta. I was quite interested to look at online at a site which was a Theravadan Buddhist site discussing anatta. In typical Theravadan manner, they mention how this particular concept is not really understood or appreciated in the Mahayana tradition. They don't really understand this term. But of course, that's just typical, because the Mahayanists talk about all kinds of things that the Theravadins just really have not come to understand or appreciate. Anyway, and it was interesting. This term anatta is usually translated as no self or non-self. And this person said it's a little better to say not in itself. But eventually in the discussion, he stresses that apparently what the Buddha was initially referring to with this term had to do with that the nature of things is such that they really can't be managed or controlled. Whether it's your body, whether it's your food, whether it's your car, whether it's your children or wife or husband, nothing can be very fully controlled. So this writer was saying it's not so much about self or not self, but it's that in a practical, I mean, this idea of self and not self in some ways is quite intellectual and has perhaps less of a practical application. But if you think about the ability to control something, that's a little more relevant to our daily life. So when it comes to the road, for instance, we might clean out all the ditches along the road, which I hope to do before the rains come. And we can have every ditch completely clear. And then the rain starts, and then all the water will naturally flow into all the right places, and no water will flow across the road and wash the road out. But it might happen that the rain comes rather heavily and some branches fall off, or a lot of leaves are knocked off the trees and they fall into the ditch, and then they make a little dam, and then the leaves fill in behind that, and then pretty soon you have the water being redirected from the ditch across the road. So that's anatta. You could say, well, the self of the ditch's self didn't function right or something, but the idea is that you don't have very much control over the situation. You can control it most of the time, but there always come a time when you don't quite have it together, or that it outwits you somehow. And certainly it's true in this little garden we're putting in here. No matter how nicely you plant the plants and water them or don't water them too much or whatever, then a deer might come along, or the gopher, as has just happened. And suddenly the plant isn't there because something uncontrollable has happened. So this uncontrollability, or as we usually understand it in the Mahayana tradition, the non-selfness of things. Of course, this non-self then in the Mahayana tradition is directly expressive of the idea of the interdependence of all things. Everything is a part of and interconnected with everything else. And there's no one thing that stands absolutely alone. So this cup of tea, you know, comes from myriad conditions and activities. I wanted to give an example of, I suppose you could say uncontrollability and also non-self. When I was not too long after Roosevelt died, there was the end of World War II, and I remember going. We lived in Glendale at the time, near Los Angeles, and we went downtown Glendale, and there was a parade, and there were, I remember in the some stores and so on, there were posters with a picture of Hitler and Hirohito, both, and these were the terrible enemy. They looked like crazy crooks, you know, both of them, and that was the image that I had, you know, sort of embedded in my mind from the end of World War II. Then when I was in high school, I happened to read in the paper or something that the Emperor of Japan and his wife were coming to the United States and were paying a state visit and so on. this is all very wonderful, and his name was Hirohito. Hirohito, that jerk, that terrible, vicious man with huge glasses and funny teeth. Sure enough, it was the same man who came, and he was the Emperor of Japan, and it was all just wonderful. So it was certainly a shocking experience of anatta and of anicca and so on. So I wanted to close with a final story from my childhood, which was the reason I want to tell this little event is because we have these teachings or these understandings which are simply expressive of the way things are, or as life is, reality is. It's not something that we will eventually experience or eventually understand. We already are doing it or being it or experiencing it just all the time, whether we like it or not. So we're right with all of this, and we know it all in, to some degree, and whether we really acknowledge it or not is perhaps the real point. So when I was again quite young, I don't know if it was before or after the end of the war, I think it must have been just after the end of the war, we were driving, I think, across the bridge, which was kind of a large road, Glendale Boulevard, going to Los Angeles, and we were going to visit my grandparents. We were riding along in our car, and it was a four-lane road, and our car passed this other car, and I looked at this other car, and it was a Rolls-Royce. Now, I don't know how I knew it was a Rolls-Royce, because they almost... never saw them in those days, and I mean, my goodness, that was like something incredible. So here was this Rolls Royce, and we were going faster than this Rolls Royce, and I couldn't figure out why would those people with such a fantastic automobile, why would they be going so slow? So I was thinking about that for quite a while for some reason, and suddenly it came to me, well, they don't have to get anywhere. They're already there. So in a sense, that's our situation, whether we like it or not. We're all manifesting our Rolls-Royce